Welcome to The Debate. You know, usually when we analyze these massive historical paradigm shifts, we're looking for incredibly complex, multi-layered triggers.
Right, the invisible structural forces.
Exactly. But sometimes history hinges on an image so stark, it almost feels, scripted. Imagine a grandmaster chess tournament.
Okay, paint the picture.
So the establishment players have spent their entire lives studying, like, the Sicilian defense. They're analyzing every possible permutation of the board, completely locked in to the rigid rules of the game.
The 1990s operating system of politics.
Right. And then a reality television star simply walks into the room, steps right onto the board, and the elites, well, they look at him and assume he doesn't even know how the knight moves, so they just ignore him.
Yeah, that is the establishment's narrative in a nutshell, isn't it? But, you know, the critical question we really have to ask ourselves when looking back at that moment is this. Did he actually know how the knight moved, or did he just flip the entire board over while the grandmasters were busy looking the other way?
Because overturning the board doesn't exactly require strategy.
Right. It doesn't make you a strategic grandmaster. It just means you recognize that the institutional referees had lost their authority and, well, the rules were suddenly completely unenforceable.
And that tension right there, that is the absolute core of what we are unpacking today. We are looking closely at the 2015-2029 dossier.
Specifically, Chapter 1.
Yes, Chapter 1, which covers the absolute political earthquake of the 2015-2016 cycle. And just to be clear for everyone, this exchange is grounded entirely in the macroeconomic data, the localized labor statistics, and the media analysis found within that specific source dossier.
No outside speculation, just the historical record provided.
Exactly. Now, I look at that data and I see a unique visionary catalyst, a brilliant political strategist who correctly diagnosed a fundamentally broken system and masterfully weaponized new technology to break the establishment's absolute monopoly on power.
And, well, I come at it from a completely different angle. Looking at that exact same data, I argue that the candidate was merely a symptom, essentially an invasive species entering a highly fragile political ecosystem that lacked the institutional antibodies to fight off entertainment-driven populism.
So you see him as an opportunist.
A populist opportunist who ignited the dry tinder of decades-long economic devastation and leveraged the toxic algorithms of social media to fundamentally degrade our civic discourse.
Well, let's start with that initial spark, because the establishment's reaction to it reveals the core of their entire blind spot. June 16, 2015.
The Golden Escalator.
The visuals of that day are just burned into the historical record. The gold brass, the marble, the sheer glitz of a Manhattan billionaire descending the escalator in Trump Tower.
It was incredibly cinematic.
It was. And politicians across the spectrum, the media, international observers, they look at this and universally dismiss him. I mean, they saw a man whose primary cultural footprint at that moment was a reality show called The Apprentice and a catchphrase.
You're fired.
Right. They thought it was a PR stunt.
Well, they looked at his resume and saw a totally blank page. No local political experience, no city council runs, no law degree, no time in the Senate or a governorship, no military service either.
Which is usually a prerequisite.
In the traditional political world, yes, that is a fatal bug in the software. You just don't survive the primary process without that foundation.
But I would argue he actively weaponized that exact lack of experience. He took that, along with his billionaire status, and used it as a strategic shield.
A shield? How so?
Well, you look at those early primary debates. He is standing on a stage with 16 seasoned politicians, right? Governors, senators, establishment darlings who have spent their entire lives climbing the ladder.
The ultimate insiders?
Exactly. Now, the traditional view of a billionaire in a gold-plated penthouse is that he is the ultimate elite, completely disconnected from the working class. But he pulled off this this incredibly sophisticated rhetorical judo move.
Rhetorical judo. Okay, I'm listening.
He pointed at those 16 politicians and basically said they're all bought and paid for by super PACs and wealthy donors, And I know this because I used to be one of those donors.
Right, the "I know the system is rigged because I rigged it" argument.
Yes, he claimed that because he was self-funding his campaign, he couldn't be bought by lobbyists. It was brilliant.
Well, you're calling it rhetorical judo, but I think you're giving the maneuver way too much credit as a grand strategy.
You don't think it was strategic?
I think the lack of immediate destruction of his campaign wasn't because of his strategic brilliance. It was a byproduct of the establishment's profound cognitive dissonance.
How do you mean?
The political immune system usually attacks outsiders immediately, right? With opposition research, negative ad buys, surrogate attacks.
Sure, they crush them early.
But the immune system didn't trigger here, because they were judging a 2015 reality using a 1990s operating system. They assumed a lack of experience was a fatal flaw.
Break that down a bit. What is the 1990s operating system?
I mean, the rules of engagement that governed politics for, like, 25 years. In the 90s and 2000s, you survived by speaking in carefully calibrated, focus-grouped language. You avoided gaffes at all costs.
You never went off script.
Exactly. You never insulted a war hero. You never used crude language on a debate stage. And you always presented this veneer of polite statesmanship.
Which he completely threw out the window.
He did. And the establishment assumed that because he violated all these rules, gravity would simply take over and he would implode on his own. So they gave him a free pass in those early months.
They treated him like a sideshow.
Right. They didn't realize that angry voters were increasingly viewing his total disregard for those 1990s rules not as a disqualifier, but as his strongest feature.
But see, that is exactly where the strategic brilliance comes in. He engineered a scenario where their traditional weapons were rendered entirely useless.
By just being loud.
No, by positioning himself as the traitor to his own class. By admitting he knew the system was corrupt, because he had participated in the corruption, he turned his elite billionaire status into the ultimate anti-establishment credibility.
It's an interesting paradox, I'll give you that.
It wasn't an accident that he dismantled the Bush political dynasty on that primary stage. He recognized that the focus-grouped acronyms and the polite statesmanship you're talking about, they were actually driving voters insane.
Because it felt entirely inauthentic.
Because it felt like a mask, yes.
Look, I'm not denying it was effective, but to call it a master strategy implies he built a new paradigm. He didn't. He just recognized that the audience was already desperate for anyone to attack the system.
So you think it was just pure luck?
Not luck. Opportunism. It wasn't that the voters deeply believed a Manhattan real estate developer was one of them, you know, sitting at their kitchen table understanding their daily struggles.
Then what was it?
It was that they hated the 16 polished politicians on that stage who spoke in those vague terms. Those traditional politicians were operating like animals with camouflage in a carefully cultivated ecosystem.
Trying not to offend anyone.
Trying to keep the donor class happy. So when this invasive species enters, loudly mocking the very rules of the ecosystem, the voters didn't care about the hypocrisy of his wealth.
They just cared that he was holding a wrecking ball?
Exactly. The voters didn't want someone to govern the system. They wanted someone to dismantle it.
I see why you want to frame it as just an opportunistic wrecking ball, but I think you're treating the voters as if they just blindly latched on to the first loud noise they heard.
I'm not saying they were blind. I'm saying they were angry.
But you're treating the candidate as if he just stumbled into a lucky dynamic. The data in Chapter 1 shows a candidate who actively identified the precise hypocrisy of the system.
Give me an example of that active identification.
Let's look at the actual substance of those primary debates. He didn't just attack his opponent's physical appearances or energy levels, though yes, he did do that.
Profusely.
But he also uttered frontally critical remarks about the war in Iraq. Within the Republican primary base at that time, criticizing the Iraq War or the Bush family legacy was considered absolute sacrilege.
It was political suicide under the old rules.
It was completely unthinkable. Yet he did it anyway. He recognized that the old rules of political decorum were alienating the voters. He didn't just hold a wrecking ball. He provided the exact architectural blueprints of where the system was failing.
I wouldn't really call blunt one-line slogans architectural blueprints, to be honest.
Well, they resonated like blueprints to the people listening.
Sure, but to really understand why the voters were so incredibly receptive to that wrecking ball, we have to look away from the debate stages and the golden escalators.
Where should we look?
We have to look at the macroeconomic dashboard versus the reality on the ground in the Rust Belt. Because if you were sitting in Washington, D.C., or a coastal media hub, or an Ivy League economics department in 2015, your dashboard was flashing entirely in the green.
You're talking about the post-2008 recovery metrics.
Exactly. Let's look at the aggregate data they were relying on. The stock market had recovered from the Great Recession and was consistently breaking records.
The national unemployment rate was dropping steadily month over month.
Yes, gross domestic product was growing. By the mathematical metrics that economists had used for a century to judge national health, the engine of American capitalism was humming perfectly.
On paper, everything looked great.
Right. They treated the American economy like an airplane, where average altitude is all that matters. As long as the plane averages 30,000 feet, the establishment is popping champagne in the cockpit.
But they ignored that the nose was at 60,000 feet and the tail was scraping the ground.
Precisely. If you actually put your ear to the ground in the industrial heartlands, places like Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you didn't hear a humming engine.
What did you hear?
You heard a terrifying, tearing sound. The macroeconomic data was completely masking a profound, localized depression.
And this is where the dossier gets incredibly granular, which I appreciate. It outlines this cascading sociological failure that had been bleeding out over 15 years.
It wasn't overnight.
No, this wasn't a sudden hurricane that hit the Midwest. It was a slow-motion collapse driven by globalization, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and, critically, the integration of China into the World Trade Organization back in 2001.
Let's walk through the actual mechanism of that collapse, because it is absolutely vital to understanding the trust deficit we see in 2015.
Let's do it.
When a factory paying middle-class wages in Ohio shuts down because it can't compete with subsidized overseas labor, it's not just 2,000 jobs lost. That is just the first domino in a brutal chain reaction.
Walk me through that chain reaction, because I think people hear factory closes and they don't realize how it dismantles an entire municipality.
It starts with the velocity of money. Those 2,000 paychecks disappear from the local economy overnight. Suddenly, the local diner that those workers ate at every Friday night sees a 40% drop in revenue.
And they have to close their doors.
They close. The local hardware store goes under. Then the municipal tax base completely collapses. A massive portion of the town's property taxes and local income taxes simply vanish.
So the town can't function.
Right. The town can no longer afford to pave its roads. It has to lay off police officers and firefighters. The public schools lose their funding and cut programs.
And once the schools degrade, the demographic shift happens.
Exactly. Anyone with the youth and the means to leave migrates to the coastal cities or the Sun Belt. You are left with an aging population, plummeting property values, and an opioid epidemic rushing in to fill the vacuum of despair.
Deep, deep communal resentment.
A total sociological collapse.
And the critical psychological component here, which is where I argue the candidate's genius really comes in, is what the establishment was doing while this 15-year bleed was happening.
They were looking at the green dashboard.
Yes. The political elites of both parties are going on Sunday morning television, pointing at their green dashboard and talking about the incredible, undeniable benefits of global free trade.
They suffered from what academics call epistemological closure.
Break that down. Epistemological closure.
It means they were so locked inside their own ideological echo chamber that their brains literally couldn't process data that contradicted their worldview.
Because free trade was the bipartisan religion.
Exactly. They believed so deeply in the bipartisan consensus of free trade that it would lower the cost of consumer goods and lift global poverty that they categorized the destruction of the American Rust Belt as just an unfortunate but necessary transition period.
A transition toward a service and information economy.
Right. If the aggregate GDP was up, the system was working. They simply couldn't hear the screams from the engine room.
And that profound disconnect is precisely what the candidate recognized and weaponized. Imagine, you are a 55-year-old former steel worker in one of those hollowed-out towns.
Okay, putting myself in their shoes.
Your entire family history is rooted in that industry.
You turn on your television and you see seasoned politicians, bank executives, and traditional journalists celebrating a booming, roaring economy.
It would feel like you live on a different planet.
It is pure cognitive dissonance. It's maddening. The rhetoric out of Washington made absolutely no sense when compared to the reality on your kitchen table.
Well, and the establishment wasn't just out of touch. They were actively condescending.
Yes. They were telling these lifelong industrial workers to just, you know, learn to code and move to California.
It was immense hubris on the part of the establishment. The condescension was palpable.
Right. And out of a primary stage of 16 seasoned politicians, this outsider was the only one willing to step up to the podium, strip away the academic, focus-grouped filter, and directly address that specific pain.
He definitely spoke directly to it. He didn't offer a 14-point white paper on transitional economic subsidies. He didn't talk about job retraining grants.
Which is what a traditional politician would do.
Exactly. Instead, he pointed directly at the cameras and said, "They are stealing your jobs. Our leaders are stupid. I'm going to tear up NAFTA, I'm going to punish companies that leave, and I'm going to protect American industry."
It was a very blunt instrument.
But he was the only one who didn't treat their localized depression as a necessary sacrifice for the national GDP. That isn't just striking a match, as you put it. That is a candidate identifying a fatal flaw in the political consensus and fundamentally re-engineering political strategy to address the ignored.
Well, I hear you framing that as re-engineering political strategy, but I would push back heavily on the word strategy.
Why? It worked, didn't it? It worked to win an election, yes. But he didn't offer a substantive alternative architecture for a 21st century global economy. He offered unworkable, simplistic nostalgia.
You think he was just selling the past?
Absolutely. You cannot bring back 1970s manufacturing jobs that have been automated by robotics by simply yelling about trade deficits.
But the psychological impact.
The psychological impact was massive, I agree. To your point about that, the trust deficit was incredibly vast. These communities had lost faith in politicians, multinational corporations, and the media.
They viewed them as actively complicit in their decline.
Right. And when you have a trust deficit that deep, the population is essentially covered in dry tinder. Any opportunist with a match can create a massive fire.
So you still see him as just an opportunist?
Yes. The candidate didn't build a new consensus. He simply exploited the vulnerability of the system by validating anger without providing actual, executable policy solutions. He just pointed at the broken engine and shouted that it was broken.
But in politics, validation is a profoundly powerful mechanism. The fact that the establishment refused to even acknowledge the engine was broken gave him the absolute monopoly on that validation.
A monopoly on anger, essentially.
And to deliver that validation, he had to completely revolutionize how a candidate communicates, which brings us to the technological shift detailed in the dossier.
The revolutionary use of Twitter.
Exactly. And this is where the debate over democratization versus degradation really crystallizes.
It's a fascinating technological leap.
Let's contextualize it historically. If we look back at how presidents have bypassed traditional media filters to reach the public, we see a clear lineage of technological adaptation.
FDR and the radio.
Right. In the 1930s, FDR used the radio for his fireside chats to completely bypass hostile newspaper publishers who controlled the print narrative.
Then television in the 60s.
Exactly. JFK utilized the visual power of television in a way Richard Nixon fundamentally didn't understand. And then in 2008 and 2012, Barack Obama pioneered the use of big data, email harvesting, and micro-targeting.
All ways to reach the voter directly.
But in 2015, this candidate took the 140-character tweet and turned it into the most potent political weapon of the modern era.
It was undoubtedly potent. I'll give you that. But we really must dissect the mechanics of why it was potent, and more importantly, what it did to the psychological fabric of the electorate.
Well, let's start with the democratization aspect. Before 2015, a presidential candidate was heavily dependent on a handful of major news networks and national newspapers.
The legacy media.
The editorial boards of the New York Times, the television producers at CNN and Fox News, they were the ultimate gatekeepers. They decided what the news of the day was.
They set the national agenda.
Right.
If a candidate wanted to make a statement, the friction was massive. They had to draft a press release, run it through a communications committee, send it to a reporter, and hope an editor decided it was worthy of the evening broadcast.
They were entirely at the mercy of the establishment's translation of their words.
The editorial friction.
Yes, the editorial friction.
Well, Twitter completely eradicated that friction. It was like replacing a curated, slow-moving daily newspaper with a live megaphone, broadcasting directly into the pockets of millions of voters at 3 a.m.
A very loud, very angry megaphone.
But it was raw, unfiltered, and highly authentic. It allowed a candidate to speak directly to the citizens without the coastal elites translating, softening, or contextualizing his words.
I see why you think bypassing gatekeepers is a form of democratization, but honestly, we have to look at the architectural mechanics of the platform itself.
You don't think it was a digital public square?
No. You are treating Twitter like it was a neutral public square, like a digital town hall where people gather to rationally hear ideas. It was absolutely not that.
What was it then?
Social media platforms in 2015 were transitioning from chronological feeds to algorithmic engagement feeds. They are profit-driven architectures built on code designed to maximize user engagement.
And you argue that inherently corrupts the message.
I argue it fundamentally hacks the human nervous system. Let's look at how the algorithm actually works. The algorithm doesn't care about truth. It doesn't care about nuance, and it certainly doesn't care about civic health.
It only cares about attention.
It cares about one metric, dwell time. How long can it keep your eyes glued to the screen?
Right, so it serves you what keeps you looking.
Exactly. And what do neurological studies and platform data tell us about engagement? The emotions that drive the fastest clicks, the most retweets, and the highest retention are anger and moral outrage.
Because fear and anger are primal responses.
Yes. If a tweet makes you furious, your amygdala activates. You stop scrolling, your heart rate elevates, and you type a furious reply. The platform's code reads that engagement and immediately pushes that tweet to a million more feeds to harvest their attention and sell ads against it.
Okay, I hear that. But you can't deny the strategic brilliance of his earned media approach within that system.
Brilliant for his campaign, terrible for the country.
But by firing off a highly controversial, unfiltered tweet at 6 a.m., he hijacked the rhythm of the entire media ecosystem. He utilized the academic theory of agenda setting perfectly.
Explain how you see agenda setting working in this specific context.
Well, agenda setting is a theory that the press might not be successful in telling people what to think, but they are stunningly successful in telling them what to think about.
Sure. They frame the daily conversation.
Right. And the traditional campaigns were operating on a 1990 schedule. They were waiting until 10 a.m. to release a polished focus group statement about, say, tax policy.
A very slow, deliberate process.
But by 7 a.m., the outsiders already tweeted an outrageous insult or a sweeping policy demand in 140 characters. So by 8 a.m., every cable news morning show has scrapped their planned rundown.
They throw out the script.
Every producer is scrambling to host panels debating that 6 a.m. tweet. He forced the entire establishment media to play defense on his terrain every single day. He earned billions of dollars in free airtime because the media simply couldn't look away.
They couldn't look away because conflict is the financial lifeblood of cable news. You're describing a deeply toxic, symbiotic relationship, not a master strategy of democratization.
But he bypassed them.
He bypassed the press to speak directly to his base, yes, but he simultaneously forced the press to broadcast his message to the rest of the world.
Because he knew how to play them.
The networks would literally show an empty podium on a tarmac for 30 minutes waiting for his plane to land, simply because his unpredictability spiked their ratings. But this brings us right back to the degradation of discourse.
How so?
When the algorithm and the cable news cycle reward only the most extreme, provocative statements, traditional debate vanishes.
But didn't traditional debate already fail the Rust Belt?
That doesn't excuse replacing it with a mechanism that destroys nuance entirely. You cannot explain the intricacies of a bilateral trade agreement, or the complexities of healthcare reform, or macroeconomic transition in 140 characters.
No, you can't.
It is physically impossible. But in 140 characters, you can completely destroy an opponent's career without any room for a nuanced rebuttal.
Because the medium favors the attack.
The medium itself shifted the political currency away from facts, policy, and coalition building, and replaced it entirely with speed, emotion, and viral outrage. You're praising him for mastering the algorithm, but I'm asking you to look at what the algorithm did to the country. It didn't empower voters, it addicted them to conflict.
I'm not entirely convinced by that line of reasoning because you are assuming that the nuanced debate of the traditional era was actually serving the public.
I think it served the Republic better than viral outrage.
But you're mourning the death of the 14-point white paper. The voters in the hollowed-out towns of Michigan didn't care about a nuanced white paper on healthcare because those white papers had never protected their jobs, their schools, or their towns.
They felt abandoned by the nuance.
They viewed those white papers as weapons of obfuscation used by the elite. The speed and emotion of social media finally matched the speed and emotion of their real-world anxiety.
It amplified their anxiety, certainly.
And the traditional media thought their constant fact-checking and condemnation of his tweets would act as a disqualifier. They assumed they still held moral authority.
But they didn't realize they had completely lost their own credibility.
Which brings us to the most fascinating and frankly structural data point in this entire dossier.
The phenomenon of negative partisanship.
Yes, and how it completely defined the 2016 general election.
Let's look at that ultimate showdown, November 8th, 2016. You have the political outsider facing off against Hillary Clinton, who the dossier describes as the absolute distillation of the traditional political establishment.
The quintessential insider.
Let's just review her resume. She was a former first lady who lived in the White House for 8 years, a two-term senator from New York, and a former secretary of state.
Highly credentialed.
On paper, under the 1990s operating system, she was completely unbeatable. She had the endorsements, she had the donor network, she had the debate prep, she had the traditional media's respect, and the establishment's polling models all predicted a comfortable and inevitable victory.
But they failed to account for how negative partisanship inverted the laws of political physics.
Let's define the mechanics of that inversion.
In a traditional environment, say the year 2000 or 2004, if the major newspapers, the network anchors, and the establishment figures of both parties universally condemn a candidate, that candidate loses. Independent voters, their funding dries up and their campaign collapses.
Because in a traditional environment, the media serves as a trusted referee.
Correct. They enforce the boundaries of acceptable behavior.
But in an environment with a massive structural trust deficit, that exact same condemnation acts as a supercharged endorsement.
An endorsement from the enemy?
Yes. The voters in the Rust Belt had entirely lost faith in the media and the political elites. They viewed them as the architects of their misery. So when a newspaper that they fundamentally believed was lying to them wrote a scathing front-page editorial calling the outsider a dangerous threat to democracy, the voters immediately assumed he must be doing something right.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
The logic was literally, if the people who destroyed my town hate this guy, he must be my guy. He wore the media's attacks as a badge of honor. I maintain this was an asymmetrical warfare that he masterminded.
Masterminded is a strong word.
Well, the harder the system pushed against him, the more authentic he appeared to a base that desperately wanted the system dismantled.
I agree that negative partisanship was a powerful, gravity-defying force. But again, to call it a masterminded asymmetrical warfare gives way too much credit to the candidate, and it completely ignores the structural blind spots of the polling industry that allowed the shock of election night to actually happen.
The polling models definitely failed.
They failed spectacularly. But they didn't fail because the outsider possessed some magical ability to warp reality. They failed because of distinct, identifiable methodological errors in how data was collected and weighted.
Walk me through the polling mechanics. Why were the grandmasters so blind to the incoming checkmate?
Pollsters build models based on assumptions of who is going to turn out to vote, right?
Based on historical data.
Exactly. In 2016, pollsters fundamentally missed the non-college educated, rural and industrial white voters in their weighting. They looked at historical turnout models and assumed these voters would stay home at the same rates they always did.
Because they usually felt disconnected from the process.
Right. The pollsters didn't adjust their samples correctly to account for the massive surge in enthusiasm among a demographic that felt ignored for decades. But there was a second psychological layer to the polling failure that is even more telling.
The social desirability bias.
Yes, the shy voter effect.
Ah, right. Break that down for us.
Because the traditional media so heavily stigmatized the candidate, painting any support for him as morally repugnant, racist, or ignorant, many voters simply lied to pollsters.
They didn't want to admit it on the phone.
They refused to admit to a stranger on the phone that they were voting for him. They didn't want to deal with the social friction. This artificially skewed the predictive models heavily toward Clinton.
I actually think that is the ultimate aha moment of the 2016 cycle. The ultimate irony is that the media's moral crusade against him didn't suppress his voters. It just drove them underground.
It made them invisible to the establishment.
The polling models didn't fail because of a math error. They failed because the establishment made it socially unacceptable to tell the truth. They blinded themselves with their own moral superiority.
It was a massive echo chamber.
They built an echo chamber so thick that they couldn't hear the wrecking ball swinging toward the building.
That's a fair assessment of the media's failure, honestly. The underlying forces of economic resentment and institutional distrust were clearly visible in the sociological data for anyone willing to look.
If they had just stepped out of New York or D.C.
Right. The shock on election night wasn't that he won. The shock was the profound arrogance of a political class so insulated in their own coastal echo chambers that they couldn't conceive of a world where their consensus was forcefully rejected.
And that rejection completely shattered the so-called blue wall, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
The three states that decided the election.
These were states that had reliably voted for the Democratic presidential candidate for decades. They were considered the impregnable foundation of the establishment's electoral map.
They took them completely for granted.
But when you apply the macroeconomic reality we discussed earlier, the slow-motion collapse of the Rust Belt and the deafening silence of the green dashboard, it makes perfect sense.
The contrast in messaging was stark.
Extremely. While the Clinton campaign ran on a message of steady competence, incremental progress, and America is already great, essentially promising to manage the existing system responsibly, the outsider's hyper-focused, emotional message about renegotiating trade agreements and closing borders acted like a laser cutting directly through the mortar of that blue wall.
We do have to maintain perspective on the data here, though.
What do you mean?
It wasn't a sweeping, unanimous national revolution. The mandate was incredibly fragile.
Well, he won the Electoral College definitively.
Yes, it was a razor-thin Electoral College victory achieved by intensely exploiting localized pain in those three specific states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, won by a combined margin of around 77,000 votes.
A tiny fraction of the electorate.
Exactly. And simultaneously, he lost the national popular vote by millions. That doesn't demonstrate the unifying genius of a visionary candidate who built a new American majority.
So what does it demonstrate?
It demonstrates the extreme vulnerability of the electoral system to hyper-targeted, algorithmically amplified populist grievance. It proved that a highly motivated, angry minority could leverage the structural quirks of the Electoral College to seize power over the establishment.
But whether you view it as strategic genius or systemic vulnerability, the result was a political earthquake that fundamentally realigned the geopolitical landscape.
It certainly shook the globe.
The dossier explicitly notes the immediate global shockwaves on the morning of November 9th, 2016. We really have to look at the global context to understand the sheer magnitude of this paradigm shift.
The panic in European capitals was palpable.
Absolutely. The entire post-Cold War international order was built on a series of fixed assumptions by the global elite.
Such as?
Assumption one, the United States would always champion global free trade and expand the WTO. Assumption two, the U.S. would unconditionally maintain and fund the NATO military alliance as the bulwark of Western security.
And assumption three was the reliance on multilateral treaties like the UN.
Yes, that multilateral cooperation was the only way forward. Overnight, a president was elected on an America First platform who referred to these foundational pillars not as sacred duties, but as bad deals where America was being ripped off.
The anchor of the global system appeared to be detaching itself.
Foreign governments were scrambling, completely bewildered. They were trying to figure out if the U.S. was going to abruptly withdraw from climate treaties or literally demand mafia-style protection money for military alliances.
The religion of Davos was shattered.
The idea that globalization was an inevitable, secret, irreversible process, which was the religion of Davos in the World Economic Forum, was completely wiped out in a single night.
And it empowered similarly minded movements abroad.
Right. Conversely, while the elites panicked, it served as a massive proof of concept for populist movements globally. In the UK, which had just sent their own shockwave by voting for Brexit, and in countries like France, Italy, and Hungary, populist factions hung at the flags.
They saw a path to victory.
For them, 2016 was the ultimate evidence that a mobilized, nationalistic working class could successfully defeat a highly educated, deeply entrenched global elite. It permanently shattered the assumptions of modern politics.
It certainly redefined the terms of the debate.
It proved that cultural identity, national borders, and economic protectionism had replaced the old left-right tax-and-spend economic debates as the new political currency. This wasn't just a sudden thunderstorm that would eventually clear up, you know? This fundamentally changed the geopolitical climate. The very definition of the word outsider flipped.
How so? How did it flip?
Prior to 2015, being an outsider meant you lacked the experience to govern safely. You were a risk. After 2016, being a political insider became the ultimate liability.
It became a stain on your record.
Having a resume full of government service meant you were part of the rot. That is a permanent shift in the democratic paradigm.
Well, I agree that it marked a profound shift, but the historical debate the dossier presents is whether the individual was the cause of this shift or merely a symptom of a much larger decay.
And you lean towards symptom?
The sociological data strongly suggests the latter. The candidate was a highly effective catalyst, I will definitely grant you that. He played the new media environment with an almost feral instinct.
He knew how to manipulate attention.
But the true permanent shift we have to grapple with is the dangerous intersection of structural economic inequality and algorithmic media.
The structure over the individual.
Exactly. He didn't invent the rural-urban divide. He didn't engineer the hollowing out of the Rust Belt. He didn't write the code for Twitter's engagement algorithms that hijacked the amygdala.
No, he just utilized them.
He just tapped into an oil well of societal pressure that had been building for 20 years and threw a match down the pipe.
But recognizing the pressure, finding the pipe, and having the sheer audacity to throw the match requires a unique agency that the establishment simply did not possess.
Because they were too comfortable.
They didn't even know the oil well was there.
Perhaps. But that leads to a chilling forward-looking question raised by the sociologists analyzing this era.
What's the question?
We have spent an hour dissecting how effectively this asymmetrical warfare worked using the relatively primitive technology of 2015.
Primitive. I mean, Twitter revolutionized the media.
Compared to what's coming, yes. A 140-character text platform is incredibly primitive. The text-based algorithms of 2015 simply rewarded anger, and that alone was enough to completely break the political immune system of the world's oldest democracy.
So you're worried about the next iteration?
Technology does not stand still. If the democratic institutions of 2016 could not withstand a billionaire armed with a smartphone and a blunt message, how in the world will our current ecosystem survive the invasive species of the future?
You're talking about the weaponization of artificial intelligence.
Exactly. Imagine a future candidate who doesn't just tweet angry text, but who is armed with the artificial intelligence of tomorrow.
It's a terrifying prospect, honestly.
Hyper-realistic deepfakes that can manufacture a scandal overnight. Perfectly tailored, micro-targeted virtual reality campaigns designed by autonomous algorithms to exploit not just broad cultural anger, but our deepest, most specific subconscious fears based on our individual data profiles.
Taking the 2016 model and putting it on steroids.
Yes. If a reality TV star flipped the board in 2016, what happens when an AI-driven populace simply deletes the board entirely? Are our democratic systems, designed by men in the 18th century using parchment and quill, remotely prepared for that?
That is a profound and incredibly unsettling question. It really forces us to look at the fragility of our institutions, not just historically, through the lens of 2016. But currently, as we face the next technological leap.
Which is exactly why analyzing this chapter isn't just an exercise in history. It's diagnostic for our survival.
Well, as we summarize our positions today, I maintain my core argument. The descent down the golden escalator in 2015 was the exact moment a visionary outsider fundamentally re-engineered political strategy.
And I, of course, respectfully disagree with the visionary label.
I know you do. But he saw a working class ignored by a self-congratulatory elite. He recognized that the 1990s operating system of polite political decorum was dead, and he masterfully bypassed the obsolete gatekeepers of the traditional media to break an arrogant establishment's monopoly on power.
And I maintain that the individual was merely a symptom of profound institutional rot.
The opportunist.
The establishment's arrogance and economic blindness created a massive structural vulnerability. The candidate opportunistically exploited that broken system, using anger-driven, algorithmic technology, degrading our civic discourse and institutional trust in ways we are still desperately struggling to repair.
Yet, despite our different framing of agency versus structure, whether he was the mastermind or the match, we both clearly acknowledge a shared truth revealed by this dossier.
The death of the old rules?
Exactly. The traditional political rulebook is permanently dead. The establishment's reliance on glowing 30,000-foot macroeconomic dashboards completely blinded them to the localized reality crashing on the drowned, and that blindness cost them their authority.
The post-Cold War consensus proved incredibly fragile when challenged by a candidate willing to abandon all norms. The vulnerability of the system was painfully, undeniably demonstrated.
Which means there is so much more to explore in this source material. This was only chapter one.
There's a lot more road ahead.
In our next analysis, we will open up chapter two of the dossier covering 2017 to 2021. We will examine what actually happens when the ultimate anti-rule outsider takes a seat behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office.
Because it's one thing to use a wrecking ball from the outside, it is an entirely different challenge to be put in charge of the exact institutions you just spent 2 years campaigning on destroying.
It really is. We will tease apart the daily mechanics of ruling by decree via social media, the structural, exhausting clashes with the White House press corps, the immense stress tests on the constitutional checks and balances leading to impeachment, and ultimately, the profound collision of an anti-establishment paradigm with the reality of a global crisis during the COVID-19 pandemic.
The ultimate stress test of governance over rhetoric.
So as we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with that image we started with. The grandmaster sitting at the chessboard, secure in their deep knowledge of the rules, entirely unprepared for the reality TV star walking onto the board.
Sticking to the rules while the board gets flipped.
We leave the debate unresolved. You must look at the data and decide for yourself. Was he a grandmaster playing a new asymmetrical game they couldn't comprehend? Or did he simply realize that the board was fragile enough to be flipped? Until next time, keep questioning the narrative.